If you could trade a bench warmer for the greatest of all time, you'd do it, right? Get your business a game-changing pickup by choosing the commerce platform with the internet's best converting checkout. That's Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. Whether you're a garage entrepreneur or IPO ready, Shopify is the only tool you need to start, run, and grow your business without the struggle. Shopify puts you in control of every sales channel. So whether you're selling signed football boots from Shopify's in-person POS system or vending vintage shirts on Shopify's all-in-one e-commerce platform, you're covered. And once you've reached your audience, Shopify has the internet's best converting checkout to help you turn them from browsers to buyers. What I love about Shopify is how, no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you possibly need to take control and take your business to that very next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the US, and Shopify is truly a global force, powering Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across over 170 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. This is possibility powered by Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/ranks, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/ranks to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/ranks.
Hello, this is international football commentator Derek Ray, and you're listening to the Ranks FC podcast.
Ranks squad, and welcome to Ranks FC. It's your favourite football podcast, back for another week. My name is Jack Collins, and I'll be your host today. Joining me is our transfer guru, Mr. Dean Jones. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, very good, mate. Yeah, taking to an international guru for today, which is fitting because we just had an international break, and I even went to watch an international football match, so that seems quite fitting. The less said about England v Malta, the better, but I did manage to take my son to his first England game, so there was some good that came out of it. From an England point of view, that's about, we'll leave it there, I think. But there's some good storylines, mate, happening across the world of international football, and two massive tournaments on the horizon.
Yeah, well, next summer we have a Copa America and we have European Championships. The Euro is going to be hosted in Germany. The Copa going to be hosted in the US, who thankfully actually qualified for a tournament they are hosting after seeing off, not without some trouble, Trinidad and Tobago across two legs. We're going to get to the Copa in part two. In part one, Dean's going to rank his top five favourites, early favourites for next summer's tournament. And then I'm going to flip the script and do the same with the Copa in part two. And then in part three, we've got some hot takes that we're going to address as well. So loads to get through today. I'm going to get stuck into it, DJ. And it's been an interesting international break. There's been lots of storylines, lots of narratives, lots of minnows that came close. We saw Kazakhstan and Moldova fail last night. We're recording this on Tuesday, to qualify for their first ever European Championships. They had tricky tasks. They both had to go away from home to the team above them in the group and get a victory, but neither were able to manage that. So we're not going to see those two newbies in Germany next summer, but we're going to talk about the teams who have, well, big eyes on actually claiming the throne.
Yeah, exactly. So, we'll see once we get closer to Euro 2024 exactly how this all pans out. But as we're looking at it right now, I've kind of cast my eyes across all the teams that have qualified so far, narrowed it all down and come up with the top five of potential candidates to go on and lift the trophy. Of course, Italy are the holders of the Euros right now. They saw off England on penalty kicks. Very sadly.
They saw off Ukraine on a non-given penalty kick very late on in their qualifier to actually book their spot, which was interesting, shall we say.
They have sneaked into this latest version of the Euros, with a very, very, I'm going to say lucky, lucky moment at the end of their match against Ukraine. I mean, Italy still would have been in the playoffs and they probably still would have qualified.
We said that at the World Cup and they didn't. They
were that's true.
It's probably worth pointing out that they were the better side against Ukraine, but they were lucky not to have a penalty awarded against them in the 93rd minute. So
very strange.
Roundabouts.
In the times of VAR, it's very rare that you get away with a moment like that on Mikhailo Mudryk, but maybe it was because it was Mikhailo Mudryk that he didn't get it. I don't know. Italy are not making my top five favourites for the Euros. That doesn't mean they won't win it, because they weren't favourites to win the last one either. But let's see whether they can prove themselves to be a tournament team once we're at the tournament. I'm going to start at five with the hosts, Germany. Now, I'll be honest here. I don't actually think Germany, as we can see it right now, have got a hope in hell of actually winning this tournament. I'm struggling to actually back them to do this. But they are on home soil. They're due a win. But they are a bit rubbish. Their results over the course of the year have been pretty poor, but they've changed manager. They've got Julian Nagelsmann in charge at the moment, which does give them more hope. Yogi Love obviously had made way for Hansi Flick, but his tenure was not very long. And now German fans are hoping that the Nagelsmann appointment sparks some new life into this German squad. And we'll see whether that turns out to be the case. But they've obviously got some amazing talent, and he just needs to kind of bring it all together. Germany have won this tournament before. They haven't won it since 1996. When it was held in England. But there will be a certain level of expectation in Germany that they can actually go on and do this. Now, whether they can find the goal power and these sorts of things remains up in the air. I mean, if you look at their team makeup and see that Kai Havertz played at left back and their latest match against Turkey, which they lost 3-2, you can see that this team is still being built, definitely still under construction. But you also have to remember that this is a team that has Ter Stegen in goal. It has some very solid defensive options, and Rudiger and Tarr. And even if you start digging into the depths of that defence, they've got options in and around them, both experienced and young. And you start to move up the pitch and you're like, okay, well, in midfield, you've got the likes of Kimmich. If he can come back into form again, then that's a fantastic player to have. You've got Gundogan and Goretzka. You've got Jamal Musiala. Like, you've got one of the best young players in the world. And in terms of creativity, you've got Wirtz, you've got Gnabry, you've got Sané. And then you just need that goal scorer, whether it's Thomas Müller or Füllkrug or whoever, can end up actually getting them to be contenders to win a trophy. Yeah, that's the problem. I don't think that they've got the goals in this team to even...
A problem, actually. There's actually quite a lot of them. They've got
They've
got problems at number six. We've seen, you know, Nagelsmann come out and say that Gundogan is the man that he needs to build around in the midfield, which means that it's going to be a fight between Kimmich and Goretzka and even Pascal Gross for that second spot, none of whom are potentially the natural six that you'd want to play alongside a Gundogan. There are question marks quite a lot, but I do think that in terms of who you're looking at up top, none of the options right now guarantee goals.
No, they definitely don't. And that's going to be the big problem for them. So honestly, like, they're lucky to be in this list. I am putting them in at five because I don't feel that there are five really good candidates to say that can actually go and win the Euros as it stands right now. Like, I think that you could probably make a case for the Netherlands to have been included here, but I don't think Netherlands have
also been unconvincing, to be perfectly honest with you. And to quote Gary Lineker, right, football's a simple game, 22 yeah. men chase a ball for 90 minutes and at the end the Germans always win. It does feel like that is no longer the case, and we are in this weird era where Germany have had the same kind of coaching tree for a long time. And actually, you go back to Jogi Löw and what that meant, and then Hansi Flick, who was his assistant. It feels like they are coming out of a cycle which was obviously a successful cycle. They won that World Cup back a decade ago now, but it feels like they've been within that kind of era for some time. And yet, you look at it and go, okay, what does this look like in real terms? The question it becomes, what do they look like right now? And right now they look rubbish, but can Nagelsmann turn that around? If there's someone that I think probably has the tactical nous to do that, Nagelsmann's right up there.
Yeah, exactly. That.
It's why you can't rule Italy out either, right? Because whilst they've not been particularly convincing, the more time Spalletti gets with his side, the less I can rule Italy out of actually being a force when it comes to actually kick off next summer.
Yeah, and I think that's it. And honestly, I'd probably put Germany and Italy into the same bracket as, like, who knows? Like, they've got the pedigree to do it. They've got individuals that can produce magic. They've got some emerging players that could do things that are interesting. But I don't think, if we're going to rank here favourites for a tournament, beyond the fact that Germany are playing this tournament at home, which, yeah, does definitely give you something extra, I'm not sure it's enough extra to really propel them into the higher reaches of this ranking. That leads me up to number four. And at four, I've put Spain, who I think are an interesting proposition for this. Obviously, if you don't watch loads of international football and you're like, well, I watched the World Cup and Spain didn't seem too good to me. They squeezed through their group and then they were beaten in the round of 16 by Morocco. And you'd be fair. That's absolutely fair.
On penalties, to be fair.
On penalties, but I think we saw that again, we talk about the lack of goals. Apart from the fact that they won their first game at the World Cup 7-0, like goals were hard to come by in that team as they got through it. But then obviously Spain went on and they won the Nations League and they beat Croatia in the summer. And we're in a moment now where I think we're seeing a version of a Spain team that we want to see, I think. Like, typically, I think we've all grown up in a time when the Xavi and Iniesta movement was kind of ingrained in us. Like, we knew how Spain played. We knew that they were going to get through tough spells. And we saw them win the Euros in 2008 and 2012. And it felt like they owned football in that time.
Well, they did.
And they did. I think that's because they did. But now we're looking at kind of a different version of Spain, I think. The coach is Luis de la Fuente, and he obviously has a very good handle on the players that are emerging in the Spanish unit because he's managed a lot of them at the younger age groups. And the first thing you look at when you're talking about the Spain team is, if available, their midfield would be Rodri, Pedri, Gavi, right? So that would be pretty much the best midfield you could hope for. Now, obviously, this week there's been bad news for Gavi. He's injured his knee, and we don't know by the time he gets to the Euros what his condition will be. I don't really want to speculate around that, but as it looks right now,
it doesn't look good.
It doesn't look good. So Spain are going to have to make up for that, and I think that that is a big loss. I mean, in that game, for example, Uriel Sunset ended up coming in for him, and they've got some depth, but it's certainly not going to be to the level of Gavi. But in terms of the rest of the team makeup, they got some really good players. I think Unai Simón is a very solid goalkeeper. Aymeric Laporte in defence. Pau Torres, they've got to call upon. Iñigo Martinez. They've got a decent depth pool when it comes to defenders. I'm not saying they're the best they've ever had, but I think that it's good.
It's quietly very strong, I think.
It's quietly strong, yeah.
I think a little bit lightweight would be my only kind of question mark over it. And a lot of these defenders are very good ball players. They're, you know, very competent in terms of possession, but actually when it's put up against them, we saw Spain struggle with someone like Youssef En-Nesyri. There are those issues that you can dig into. But I think that in terms of depth there, they're in a relatively good place as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, you have to talk about players like someone like Dani Carvajal, who's having this comeback season and been absolutely sensational for Real Madrid. And Alex Grimaldo, who's flying for Bayer Leverkusen and has finally got the call-ups he's been deserved for a long, long time, I think. Someone like Jose Gaya, who's part of this resurgent Valencia side. There's a lot to like, I think, about some of this defensive unit, but question marks remain about whether they are physically capable at top level football in terms of the World Cup, which is, or the European Championships, which will be physical.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, the main source of goals, it will still be Alvaro Morata, who will be viewed upon to deliver. He's having a good time. He's having a very good time of things. You've got Lamine Yamal, who's like the bright young thing in European football, like 16 years old. I'm not sure like we should or often would be pinning too much on one player, but his breakthrough is so sensational that it's not beyond him to literally take this tournament in his hands and help steer Spain to glory. He is capable of that. Let's try to temper expectations. Easy for most of us to do because we're not Spanish, but let's see how they manage to do that in Spain. But De La Fuente will have no problems at all in giving Lamine Yamal a call up to go to the Euros. Ferran Torres, Dani Olmo. We have to see who else they decide to actually call into that setup in terms of attacking options, and also who really is seen as the main backup for goals beyond Alvaro Morata. But I think one thing you will get from the Spanish team is, you know, since the days of Xavi Iniesta, it's all been about the passing and the relentless passing, and it's been too much at times, and you've been unable to maintain that identity or replicate it. And I think they've come away from that a little bit now. They still play good football, but I feel like they've got a more of a plan B or a plan C now, where they can come away from that a little if they need to. It's not going to be the same style of football that we all had ingrained in us, like I mentioned. So, yeah, I think that Spain at number four here, a team that you don't expect to win this tournament, but it's starting to head in their direction again, and this is more like the Spain of old.
What I really like about this Spain side is that the drop-off from sort of A team to B team isn't massive. So obviously you have different players coming in and out. There will be injuries. I think you look at some of the other sides, and look, obviously there are key parts in this Spain team. And, you know, if a Pedri isn't there, if Rodri isn't there, fine. But actually you look at the backups here, someone like Martin Zubimendi, who's been absolutely sensational for Real Sociedad, was on Barcelona's radar. He was apparently Xavi's number one target in central midfield. Someone like Fabian Ruiz, who has re-established himself in this PSG side. Mikel Merino, who's played alongside Zubimendi. You have, as you mentioned, Oihan Sancet, who's having another good season at Athletic Club. We haven't even mentioned the fact that Gabri Vega was part of this side and has dropped off because he's headed off to Saudi Arabia, but that doesn't change the fact that he's an incredibly talented footballer. Alex Baena, Villarreal, you've got on the wings if the original players aren't performing. Rodrigo Riquelme is having that breakthrough season at Atletico Madrid. We've seen Brian Zaragoza called up from Granada. There's a lot of really talented footballers here, and that's without going into the kind of list of players who've been in and around this squad for a while, the likes of, as you say, Dani Olmo, but Oyarzabal, who I think is a sensational footballer and I love watching. You've got someone like little Rodri at Betis, who was the star of the under-21 Euros for Spain and has kind of looked to move that form into La Liga this season. The drop-off, and as you say, De La Fuente's got that experience playing with the youngsters, so he knows what these players coming through can do. I think that that's a real tick in Spain's book, that the drop-off from one to another doesn't really exist. And whilst the top level might not be as clear-cut as someone like France or England, I think Spain have less to worry about when it comes to if one of those gets injured, do you have to restructure the whole thing? I don't think so.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And yeah, I think that this is a time to have eyes again on Spain, and international football is always great when you can start to trust Spain again. You know, you're getting a proper tournament on your hands. So yeah, I'm excited about that, to have Spain in there at number four. So there we go. Germany 5, Spain 4. At number 3, I think I've got a surprise. It's England.
Oh, wow.
This is where I'm putting England at 3. I'm honestly...
That's very defeatist of you. I've not seen anybody put England below 2 in a ranking.
Because this is real. What I've done here is real. England... I don't think England are going to win the Euros. Wow. Like, look, we have on paper, England can do it. In theory, England can do it. In practice... Can England go on and win this tournament in Germany? And I've got real, real doubts about whether they're capable of doing that. Look, England and France at the World Cup, like, there's barely anything between them, right? There's barely anything between them. It comes down to very fine moments that end up separating you. But it's those fine moments that are dictating whether England are going to have any success. And look, what Gareth Southgate's done in the duration of his time at England has been good. Like, it hasn't always been exciting, but in terms of results, in terms of outcomes, like, he's brought us a level of expectation we haven't had in years, to be honest. Like, we always had hope, but did we really expect to do anything? No. And I think that he's definitely got people believing again. And like you say, that's why most people in their rankings will have England in the top two. But I've just watched the last two matches against Malta and North Macedonia, and I cannot genuinely believe that England can go on and win a tournament. And now I know that, like, it's hard to use those matches as a gauge, and I'm not just using those as a gauge, but the players seem to struggle to lift themselves. And if the player, the manager doesn't seem to be a great motivator in times of need either. And that's what concerns me. There is a mental fragility in this England team. And time after time, they have retreated into their shells at moments during Southgate's tenure when they had opportunities to go and make history, and they haven't done it. They've had such good opportunities. If you think back to Croatia in 2018, England had a great opportunity there to go and win that game, and they started playing within themselves. Italy in that final of the last Euros in 2020, they were ahead early in that game. Fantastic opportunity to go and win it. Should have won it. Played within themselves. And France at the World Cup, they retreated again and played within themselves. They were all very winnable games. England could have won all three of those tournaments, and they didn't. And I just don't see them breaking that trend. The only way they do is because of Jude Bellingham, Harry Kane, Declan Rice, John Stones are the core of that team.
That's a pretty good core.
What happens, though, the second you take one of them out of that team?
Yeah.
They're not replaced. And you've seen that. Jude Bellingham not been in with England for this particular international window. England have just lacked ideas and spark and drive. And I've even seen people writing today like Bellingham is as important as Kane is for England now. I'm not sure that's strictly true when you look at Kane's goal scoring record, but I understand the principle that is being made. And the chances are we do have a serious injury and someone will be missing from this squad. And if that's happened, if it is a Stones or Rice or Bellingham or Kane, I just don't think we can play at the same levels. And I think that that will affect England. Look, I'll be honest. I am trying to temper expectations. I want us to have a talking point here. I don't want England to be considered for favourites for a major tournament because I don't think they've lived up to that expectation. I think that this team has done brilliantly at times. I think that they've progressed like across the board at all levels over the past 10 years. Like, there's no doubt about that. But when it comes to imposing yourselves on a big game, when it comes to showing what your identity is, when it comes to showing character, it always feels like we revert to type. And I'd love to believe that people like Jude Bellingham could take us beyond that, but I won't believe it until I see it. And this mental barrier that continues to exist, I fear will hold England back when we get to the Euros.
Someone call you a doubting Thomas, but I think there is.
I love England. I want us to go and win this tournament. And I've been, you know, I go to games. I went to the Euros when we got there. And if things start going well, I'll be as optimistic, more optimistic than anyone. But for the sake of this ranking, like trying to look at it logically, I feel that there are two teams that you can believe in more than England.
Yeah, okay, that's fair enough. I think that also, you know, on your point there about this international break, I think you do look at France and that game against Gibraltar. Now, they're not the same, the England-Malta game and the France-Gibraltar games. The difference between Malta and Gibraltar is pretty stark. But you also look at the players that France had missing in that game, the fact that there was no Camavinga, no Tchouameni in the midfield. You look at the centre-back partnership of Todibo and Upamecano. Do you think that's going to be France's starting partnership at the Euros? I don't. You look at Marcus Thuram through the middle, brilliant footballer, having an incredible season for Inter. I still think Giroud gets the nod when it comes to the Euros. And they win that game 14-0. And yes, there were circumstances in that obviously there was an own goal and a red card early on for Gibraltar and France. But the way that France put the pedal to the floor and went, yeah, we are going to just prove a point. We are going to go and smash records. We are going to go and entertain our fans at home is a very different game and a very different team to what we saw from England taking, you know, that similar lead against Malta and not being able to kind of kick through onto it. So, yeah, I absolutely appreciate what you're saying. I think that there is an element of defeatism in there. And I agree with you that obviously if there is players missing in this England setup, especially key players, then things are going to be difficult. Without Bellingham and Stones in there, then obviously you can look at this international break and go, well, two of the four you've just mentioned are missing. If they are all there, then what's to stop England? And I think the answer is, well, maybe France. But aside from that, I don't think there's many sides that could stack up to a full-strength England. But kind of in the opposite of what I just said about Spain, I think the drop-off to the B team, if you will, is far more stark from an England perspective. And that's a worry at this point, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Of course, a full-strength England can go toe-to-toe with the best. Yes, they can. But what we've seen is they still come up short. And that's something we have to see them overcome. So the team at number two that I've put above them is Portugal.
I thought you might do this.
And look, I'll be honest, in terms of trust, it's difficult to say I can trust Portugal much more than I actually trust England. But let's just put it into context for a minute. We'll dress around it. And then I know that you'll have a big say on this because you watch a lot of this team. But Portugal ended their qualification campaign with 10 wins out of 10. Yeah. Bruno Fernandes has been inspirational in a lot of ways. Since Roberto Martinez came into this job, Portugal have won every match.
They've conceded twice in 10 games.
Defensively, they've been great. They've been scoring goals and they've been winning. So when you get to analysing the squad is when I get to thinking, actually, I think I could trust these guys more than I can trust England. They've got more recent pedigree. They won the Euros in 2016. And I think you could probably say that that was a team which, yeah, they won the tournament, but that side that they actually end up winning the Euros with isn't the best side that they've had in years, is it? This team is better than the side that they have then. I think that Portugal, a lot of blame would be laid with the past manager on why they didn't live up to expectations. And I think that Roberto Martinez has started to shake off those shackles a little bit. I'll be honest, I've still got doubts about whether Roberto Martinez can do it because he didn't manage to take Belgium's golden generation to the heights that they were supposed to hit. But honestly, when you look at Portugal's squad, it is stacked. You look across the back line and you're talking about like players like Gonçalo Inácio, Ruben Dias, Antonio Silva. You've still got Pepe to call on. I believe he's still going to keep going and into the next year as an option if you wanted to go there. I'm not saying he will be your first choice, but you've got that level of experience to call upon.
He'll be 41 at the Euros. Do you back against him getting a minute? I don't. I reckon he'll get a minute.
You move forward and you've got João Palhinha, you've got Neves, you've got Bernardo Silva, you've got Vitinha, you've got Bruno Fernandes. And then in the front line, Rafael Leão, Diogo Jota, Cristiano Ronaldo, João Félix, Pedro Neto, Gonçalo Ramos. I've even forgotten some. Like, this team is so good in pretty much every area. I'm not sure what their weakest spot is, to be honest. Maybe fullback? Maybe.
Yeah, but even then, actually, this international break, I think, has shown some weakness there in that Cancelo was kind of supposed to play both sides. They had to call up Totti Gomes, who's played, you know, a fair bit now for Wolves and has worked himself in. Raf Guerreiro came back in to replace Nelson Semedo. And actually, when you look at that at full strength, Nuno Mendes, who's obviously an absolutely sensational fullback, and João Cancelo are a brilliant first choice fullback pairing. Behind them, Diogo Dalot's not having a brilliant time at Manchester United at the moment, but he has been pretty good when Portugal have called upon him. Guerreiro hasn't featured all that much for Munich yet, but when you're talking about someone who's shown his pedigree on the highest level, I think you can back that. João Mario has been excellent for Porto for a long time and is starting to really show the caliber, you know, that he was expected of when he was a youngster breaking through and everyone was like, who's this kid? And then I think in the middle, you're looking at Antonio Silva, one of the best young fullbacks in the world, Ruben Dias, one of the best fullbacks in the world, Gonzalo Inacio, still not completely convinced he can play in a back four as opposed to a back three because he spent so long at Sporting under Amorim playing in that back three system. But what we've seen of him so far at this level has been very impressive. Now, you do have to caveat that Portugal's qualification group was pretty weak. The side expected to challenge, or the most traditional of the last sort of decade side that would challenge them, would have been Bosnia and Herzegovina. Iceland obviously had their moment a couple of years back, but have really regressed since then. Luxembourg are getting better, but still miles off what you'd expect from them. And it was Slovakia who kind of turned it up and actually were the second best side in this group. Portugal beat them twice, but they beat them by narrow margins on both occasions. 1-0 away from home, 3-2 at home, although they were 3-1 up and quite comfortable until Slovakia scored an absolute screamer. So, you know, questions on how that much affected it. But yes, I mean, what we've seen so far has been sensational. They've been free-flowing, they've been free-scoring. We've seen Martinez able to actually get the best out of Cristiano Ronaldo again and not just utilizing him as a lump the ball in there and hope for the best. It's starting to actually, you know, coach those attacking patterns into this Portugal side. If they can click, there's nothing stopping them, because as a talent pool, I mean, they're up there with France and England in terms of what, you know, the amount of world-class players that you can look at this team and go, yeah, 100%, 100%, and kind of across the board, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and I think having João Félix and Rafa Leão playing at such high level at the moment is going to be a massive positive. And then it's up to the manager to decide when Ronaldo starts and when Gonçalo Ramos gets his opportunities.
Or if he just starts them together, as he's done for the last couple of games.
Yeah, and how you manage to balance that out at a tournament, I think, could be more difficult, especially once you get into the knockout matches. But yeah, Ronaldo at 39 years old by the time he gets to this tournament. We saw Messi go and win the last World Cup. Could Ronaldo follow that up by getting his own hands on an international trophy?
Big summer for the rivalry if they both go on and win international trophies.
It could be a big summer for the rivalry, mate. It really could. But yeah, let's just go and finish off this list, shall we, at number one, because we all knew what was coming the moment we started this ranking. France are the best international football team out there. They're the best side on paper, and they're also the best side on a football pitch. I was considering, when I was weighing them up against England, for example, how they fared in all the positions, and I was like, look, France are better than everyone in every area, apart from maybe England have got the edge as a striker. Maybe Kane would make an argument as a striker. And there's not really a right back, maybe, that jumps out at me as like, okay, and no one's going to be better than him. But this is a squad that is young, insane depth in pretty much every position. They're going to be the side to beat, apart from a narrow loss to Germany. They've won all of their games this year. They are playing Greece tonight, so I should caveat that. But as you say, their last game was 14-0. That's just a ruthless edge that they've got to them. They were 7-0 up at halftime, up against one of the worst teams in the world. Most teams would have eased off, made changes, thought just leave it at that. France decided to go and double it. And Mbappe bags a hat-trick. Giroud scores an injury time overhead kick. They are not messing around, this team. They've got an unbelievable blend of talent. Just to put into context how strong their squad is, for this international break that we're in right now, their squad did not include Camavinga, Tchouameni, Nkunku, Moussa Diaby, Ferland Mendy, Ibrahim Konaté, Benjamin Pavard, or Presnel Kimpembe. None of those were in this squad. So that's the strength that they've still got to call on. Yet they did still call upon Zaire Emery, Youssef Fofana, Kefrem Thuram, Rabiot. They've got Todibo in defence with Saliba, Lucas and Teo Hernandez. And then up front is ridiculous.
It's an embarrassment of riches, isn't it?
This is just, like, honestly, Griezmann, Mbappe, Giroud, Ousmane Dembele, Kolo Muani, Marcus Thuram and Kingsley Coman. That's currently their forward options. Add on to that the fact that they've got a manager like Didier Deschamps, who's been in the job since 2012 and has that I don't know, that next level that Gareth Southgate and Roberto Martinez haven't proved that they've got. France surely go on and win this tournament.
I mean, barring a miracle, I think you're right. There's like no flaws, I think is probably how I would put this in this squad. There's no position, even you say, you know, right back there. I'm looking at it and going, well, I really like Jonathan Klaus, but even if you don't, Koundé's played there at times. He's been good for Barcelona when he's played there. He doesn't really enjoy it, but I think if it was an option of not playing for France or playing at right back, he'd probably play at right back. Got Malo Gusto, who's moved to Chelsea, proved an adequate backup for Reece James, who's right up there with, you know, the best players in the world. Benjamin Pavard, again, someone who doesn't hugely like playing right back, but will definitely do a job there if it comes to it. That's not, you know, there's so many teams in the world that would kill for those options at right back. And France, they're like, not sure, that might be our weakest position, actually. It's ridiculous how deep this squad is. The midfield, I honestly think that the most interesting thing about France is how they're going to whittle this squad down to 23. Because you're talking about someone like Boubacar Kamara, who's been sensational at Aston Villa. Youssef Fofana, who's been there in this international break as well, who's had a couple of very, very good seasons at Monaco. Zaire Emery got injured in this international break. He always takes Adrien Rabiot. Then there's Kefren Thuram, who's been exceptional at Nice and is seen as one of the better players coming through in his position in the world. Then Camavinga and Tchouameni. Guendouzi's got a new lease of life at Lazio. It's just incredibly deep. This is two positions, bear in mind, because we know that Griezmann's probably going to play in that kind of 10 role where, you know, he's exceptional. And as I said last week, I think right now on form, Griezmann's probably the best player in the world. So I just can't see any weaknesses. And look, they lost in the last European Championships to Switzerland on penalties after being in complete cruise control. But their transition from that World Cup winning squad of 2018 to what we're looking at now, bear in mind, none of that midfield three will be at this tournament. N'Golo Kante, Paul Pogba, and Blaise Matuidi. None of them will be here. And we're talking about this being the deepest midfield in world football. It's ludicrous. The amount of talent in this squad, if they don't win the European Championships, something has gone drastically wrong.
Yeah, maybe they have an in-house fight again or something. Maybe it takes something like
that. The
only
thing that can stop France is France.
Oh, and it's usually the case. We usually say this. Look, when it comes up to it, like they go to the World Cup, they make it through to the final, and they lose on penalties, and it's a messy final that is really written in the stars. Like that's what it's going to take for them to not win. I think it's either an in-house crisis or
destiny,
an element of luck. Yeah, destiny.
Okay, all right. Well, I think we'll leave it there for the Euros. Now we'll move on after the break to the Copa America. Don't go anywhere.
Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
Welcome back to Ranks AFC, where we're leaving Europe behind and heading across the Atlantic Ocean. Next summer's Copa America will be held in the United States. Two venues were announced this week. The opening game is going to be held at Atlanta United's Mercedes-Benz Stadium. And then the final is going to be in Miami, which is going to be interesting, at the Hard Rock. If Argentina and Lionel Messi get there, then he's going to be playing, well, close, should we say, to home turf, home of the Miami Dolphins, of course. But we'll go through a quick top five from this one as well. And it's worth pointing out that the Copa America is the 10 teams from CONMEBOL: Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Paraguay, Peru, Uruguay, and Venezuela. And then it's going to be 6 qualifiers from CONCACAF. It's done as a kind of joint tournament between South America and North America. The only two teams that have officially qualified at the time of recording from CONCACAF are Panama and the United States. Canada are 2-1 up against Jamaica in their semi-final or in their quarter-final. And then Mexico are 2-0 down to Honduras in there. So they play tonight as we record this. By the time you listen to this, those two places will be decided, but that's okay because neither of those sides are getting anywhere near the top 5 as we look at it. Then there's play-in rounds. So Mexico, if they can't overturn that deficit, might have to go through that extra way. So we'll see what this looks like from the perspective of the last CONCACAF teams. But as you might expect, 4 of this top 5 are from CONMEBOL. I'm going to start in CONCACAF, though, at number 5, where I am going to put the USMNT. Now, this seems like a pretty weird time to be putting the US as 5th favourites, considering they lost last night to Trinidad and Tobago. But I think there were some serious caveats in that game that probably need, you know, to be addressed. Serginho Dest had an absolute meltdown. The US were 1-0 up. He'd provided an assist and everything seemed to be going pretty smoothly. And then he didn't get a series of relatively minor decisions down the right flank. He didn't get a foul that he wanted. He gave a foul away that probably was a foul that he was very unhappy about. And then he went to keep the ball in play, thought he'd done so, and the linesman called the ballers out. And Dest completely and utterly lost the plot. Like, it was, if you haven't seen this, go and look it up. It's genuinely one of the most bizarre things I've seen on a football pitch. He is being trying to be shepherded away by his teammates. Referee books him. He blows the ref an imaginary kiss. He gets booked again and sent off. He is carried away by like his teammates. He's livid. He's screaming in Tim Ream's face, who's like, what is going on? Matt Turner sort of like pushes him away to be like, get away from the ref. He appears to say, don't push me, to Matt Turner. And eventually he's off the pitch. There, Joe Scally comes on to replace him. Gio Reyna is withdrawn. And the US concede twice. Once straight after the red card and the second in the second half. And it looked for a second like it was all going to be a little bit edgy, but they actually saw it out relatively comfortably in the end. But all that aside, and you know, after the game, Tim Ream was like, he's let everyone down. He's let the players on the bench down who were going to get minutes and going to get an opportunity to show their ability. He's let the team down. And Dest has come out with a full apology and been like, I can't be doing that. But the reaction on social media was pretty vociferous. There was a lot of US fans being like, he shouldn't suit up for us again. And I was like, whoa, okay, whoa. Let's hold our horses a bit because Serginho Dest has been really, really good for PSV this season. Now, obviously, you can't behave like that. And what he did was bad. And it did let the rest of his team down. And there would have been players on that bench who would have been looking for their opportunity to show what they could do, unable to do so because the US had to completely switch systems after the red card and therefore kind of took away from that opportunity for players to show their ability to Berhalter ahead of this tournament. And I think that's a really sad thing. But with all that said, I think that the core of this US squad is starting to take real shape. And there are question marks. There's some very interesting articles published. There was a good one this morning on The Athletic about who's kind of the lock positions and what the gaps look like right now. But I actually don't think it's as bad as people are making out. Matt Turner has pretty much secured the number one shirt. The second goal last night was completely his fault. It was a really bad effort, but he has been good, I think, for Nottingham Forest. And he has generally shown that he is able to step up to that role of first-team goalkeeper. Gargas Lenin is out in Belgium at Eupen, playing week in, week out, which I think is a great thing for a 19-year-old goalkeeper. On the flanks, Dest will keep that right-back shirt if he's available because he is the best that the US have to offer. Anthony Robinson's got 2 goals in 2 for the US, which is pretty remarkable, to be honest, right now. But he's very much a cultured figure in this side now and then one of the kind of staples of it. If Tim Ream continues to play week in, week out for Fulham, he will start at left centre-back. And then on the right, there's Cameron Carter-Vickers, there's Chris Richards, Miles Robinson's had another good season at Atlanta. It all just feels quite calm. And there's been some interesting players brought through as options. You move into the midfield, Yunus Musah, we know all about his ability, but Tyler Adams is yet to come back. Weston McKennie didn't play in this game. He left the squad ahead of this one. But when those three are available, two of them at the very least are going to be playing in pretty much every game. Luca Della Torre still playing for Celta week in, week out, and playing in La Liga. And then it gives you the opportunity to allow someone like a Paxton Aronson, a Brendan Aronson, to be the rotating pieces in this cast if they're trying to move players about. Gio Reyna might well be the number 10 now. It looks like that shift to a 4-2-3-1 from a 4-3-3 has been something that Bahalt has tried to make work. Malik Tillman can play there as well. And then up top, this battle between Flo Balogun and Ricardo Pepi for the number 9, well, not the number 9 shirt, which Pepi is currently wearing, but the number 9 position is a good one and gives them both hope. And then on the wings, Christian Pulisic, Tim Weah, and there's some interesting players knocking about. I've been really impressed with Kevin Paredes, who's started to make his mark at Wolfsburg in the Bundesliga this season as well. There's lots to like about the depth in this squad. And I've been quietly impressed with how they've gone about shaping this. There's still three or four positions, I think, that aren't quite set in stone. I wonder if Johnny Cardoso's move or potential move to Betis in the summer, in the January, actually puts him into a spot to be like, I'm the backup number 6. But I think that what we're seeing from a variety of these players is that the team feels quite settled. And I think that's probably a good thing for the US going into this tournament, when a lot of these teams don't quite feel like they're there yet.
Yeah, I mean, they're still growing. I'm not optimistic that by the time we get to next summer that enough of this American new identity is going to be obvious. I think that it's going to take longer than that to grow out. But at least they've got a striker now. I think that has been a massive issue. They've got Balogun, but need to get him scoring goals, need to find out the best route to goals. Like, what's your pathway is going to be in and around the box in terms of making you carve out chances? What's your best three across the midfield? Or is it going to be a different shape from that? Like, there's a few things that are being experimented with right now. And obviously, Berhalter's still got to win over a few people among the US support.
I think that's probably an understatement, but yeah.
Still not totally forgiven him for what's gone on in the past. So there are a few underlying factors here that I think are going to hold them back in being genuine contenders to actually go on and win the Copa America. But, you know, given it's, you know, again, we talked about Germany in the last one in home soil, you have to address it.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. All right, let's move into number 4. And we talked about them as dark horses in our last Patreon episode, but this is where I've put Colombia. They're now 13 unbeaten since Nestor Lorenzo took over. And I've been very impressed quietly with what they've been doing. There've been some simple wins, you know, the likes of Bolivia, the likes of Guatemala. They've had those easy ones, but also they've proved their worth, I think, in some very interesting games of late. And actually, when you kind of look at the 2-1 win over Brazil, a lot was made of Luis Diaz, and rightly so, scoring those two goals and the emotion and the whole thing that came around that. But actually, you look at the places they've been. They traveled to Ecuador and came out with a very credible, you know, 0-0 draw. They drew 2-2 against a good Uruguay side who are right in the ascendancy. I really like what they've been doing. And I think the fact that there is now this nice blend of youth and experience coming through. You know, we've seen James come back in as captain and be kind of kind of integrated into this side. There were question marks over whether he'd retire from international football. And actually, he's come back in and been a real leader. And that move to Sao Paulo appears to have just rejuvenated his career a little bit, and definitely his international career. Behind him, I think you're looking at this kind of rock solid midfield. Matias Uribe, who was brilliant for so long for Porto. Now, obviously, Al Sadd, but still very much a heart of this. Jefferson Lerma, who moved to Palace, obviously, in the summer, but has been a sensational footballer in the Premier League for quite some time. You know, one of those real underappreciated players who does a lot of the work that goes into the heart, making a heart of a team solid. And with those two in particular, but then, obviously, there's Jorge Carrascal, who plays in Russia. It's a really strange one. He's been in Russia for quite some time now, but I really like him as a player. He's still only 25. And those three as a midfield and as an ability to kind of make things happen. They won't all play at once, I don't think, here. We're looking at maybe them playing this kind of 4-2-3-1 shape that allows James the ability to roam in the 10. But with those rotation options in the middle, Colombia are always going to be hard to break down through the center. And then you kind of sprinkle in the talent. Luis Diaz, obviously the kind of poster boy for this team. But actually Sinisterra, who has not been great since he's moved to Bournemouth, let's be good, but definitely has the ability to light games up in those individual moments. But I just think more than anything else, Colombia feel like a team once again. And actually what we've seen in recent weeks and the circumstances that have surrounded them, the comments from Lorenzo after these games and what it's meant to the players and why that, you know, they're all in the dressing room crying together about the emotion of it all. There's something about this Colombia side that I really like once again. And that I think is enough to propel them right into the conversation for next summer's tournament.
Yeah, look, togetherness counts for a lot. And especially if you've got a team that's growing in together in all sorts of ways already, then it's just going to bond them even further. And anybody that watched the Colombia 2 Brazil 1 match with Luis Diaz scoring those late two goals will see what that moment meant to everybody. Obviously, his father's story is one that captured the hearts of the world, and like we were all like watching that story pan out, and we've had an unbelievable ending to that particular chapter of it with him basically breaking down in the stands as Luis Diaz scores the winner against Brazil. But the story's not over yet for Colombia, and Luis Diaz will continue to be the talisman of this team. I mean, the way he took that match in particular into his own hands was really impressive, as we've talked about on the Patreon show. And I think that's just a taste, really, of what they're truly capable of. Can they go on and win a tournament? I mean, obviously, that's a push because of the competition level. But dark horses is the perfect way to pitch this, and I think that Colombia just riding those good vibes right now that they're building, but also knowing that this isn't just vibes, this is a very, very strong team.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's lots of good bits here. John Duran obviously playing for Aston Villa as well. Davinson Sanchez will get another go. Someone like Wilmar Barrios is still in the mix. Santos Borre, who had a good run in the Bundesliga. I'm not sure how much Cuadrado is going to play. Obviously, he's had a serious injury and isn't featuring very much for Inter at the moment. But it does feel like, despite the fact that they missed the last World Cup, they've been able to really rally. And I think it's interesting that they've got a friendly played in Miami in December, which is just going to allow for a little bit more experimentation with the local cast, because obviously I don't think the European players are going to be released for that tournament or for that game from their kind of domestic duties. So it just gives them an opportunity to, one, scout the turf a little bit, and two, to just see if there's anyone who lights things up when they're given an opportunity against a very decent Venezuela side, who I was sad to miss out of this, but haven't quite made the cut. We'll move on, and here's my shock for you. At three, I've got Brazil.
Yeah. I mean, you're writing off one of the best teams in football in history here, mate. So go on then.
I'm not writing them off. I'm saying they're third favourites.
You're saying they're not going to get past the semi-finals, mate. That's what you're doing.
Well, look, I mean, recent results haven't been great, right? And I think
I thought England at three was a push. You put Brazil there. Wow.
Well, in the last 2 weeks, they've lost to Uruguay and Colombia. And I think that what we're seeing from this Brazil side is a little bit of a lack of direction. And obviously, Fernando Diniz is in there at the moment, and we're not quite sure how long that's going to last. We're not sure who's going to be in charge of Brazil by the time this tournament rolls around. Is Ancelotti going to walk into the job with like no build-up ahead of a major international tournament? That seems like a massive risk. I think they're really, really lacking at fullback. And when I'm looking at this side and I'm thinking, look, lots of these players are very talented. But actually, if I told you that the Brazil midfield three a year ago was going to be Andre from Fluminense and then Bruno Guimarães from Newcastle and Douglas Luiz from Aston Villa, you would have laughed at me. And yet, currently, that's what it looks like. And obviously, there are players here that step in. And whether Casemiro is going to be walking into this team by the time that tournament comes around, we don't know. 31 now, a lot of rings in the legs there. And whether he's able to actually recapture the form that made him so excellent last season or not is going to have a bearing on this. Now, Lucas Paqueta might step up to be the 10 and they might switch the formation around a little bit that way. We don't know where Andre is going to be. Rumours this week that he's agreed a contract with Fulham, and whether he's going to be playing in the Premier League for the next 6 months and whether that has an impact in where he stands in this. Andre Santos is only 19, but starting to feature more and more for Forest. And we talked about him a lot in that episode that I did with Nathan and what he brings to the table. But there is a question mark over what this midfield looks like. And with Neymar now ruled out for this tournament, you know, we've seen Vinicius come in and get injured and miss a large part. And it's been a recurring series of injuries for Vinicius that are starting to look a little bit uncomfortable. Richarlison having a fall off, a massive fall off after the World Cup that he had. Brazil are nowhere near as deep as they used to be. And I think that there are rightful question marks about where they stand in the pecking order after the performances that we've seen last season. Now, I should caveat, they play Argentina tonight. And if they beat Argentina, then a lot of this is going to look very silly. But whether that happens or not, that's a derby game. Rulebook goes out the window in many, many ways. I'm just a bit concerned that they're lacking that X factor that has propelled them to heights in the past. And I think that this Brazil side right now is quite a lot worse than where it's been for the last sort of decade. And in that last decade, it's not been, you know, it's not been a vintage Brazilian decade, shall we say.
Yeah, I mean, they've got some individuals that are capable of some brilliance, and occasionally, you know, they do all come together and it's great to watch. You know, this is a team we'll all want to watch at the Copa. But yeah, I understand what you're saying. They like to obviously field as many attacking options as they can to try and fill the pitch with goals. And I mean, it's incredible the depth with which they can do that when you've got Martinelli, Vinicius Jr., Rodrigo and Rafinha starting a game. And then in reserve, you've got the likes of João Pedro and Endrick to bring into a match.
Look, so, incredibly talented players, but stack that up against the France one we just read out and tell me that Brazil are at their height.
Yeah, no, and that's it. Like that, this is a good, no, this is a very good list of players, but it's, you've got to find a way to make it work. And yeah, not convinced, like you say, that they'll do that. And yeah, there's a chance, like I mentioned in that Colombia game, like Brazil could easily have won that game, but they ended up losing it. And I think that tells you all you need to know.
Yeah, yeah. All right, at two, I've gone for Uruguay. Now, nice. Call me a Bielsa disciple, if you will, but...
You're a Bielsa disciple.
I am so sold on what this team can do. And I just love the makeup of it for a Bielsa side. I love what we've got here in front of it. I'm looking at this midfield of Ugarte, who was so good in the Primera and has now made a pretty good start to life with PSG. Bentancur, who's coming back from an injury, but on his day, one of the best centre midfielders, I think, in his position in the world. And Fede Valverde, who will run and run and run and then run some more if you ask him to. And Bielsa will ask him to. And I think you kind of pair that with this nice mix of experience in the back line. Araujo coming through as one of the best central defenders in the world, paired with someone like Jose Jimenez. Ridiculous, he's 28 years old, by the way. Like, that bloke has been around forever. He's been here for the entire life. You're looking at the fullbacks in terms of Varela, who's probably a little bit old now, but Vinha, who's moved off to Sassuolo, trying to restart his career. Oliveira, who's at Napoli. I think just generally, I'm looking at this team and going, everything about it screams Bielsa at me, and then Bielsa's in charge of it. All of it makes sense in a way that someone like Brazil right now don't. And I think you look at those two results, right? They've beaten Argentina in Argentina and Brazil at home in Montevideo in the last two games that they've played. This is a serious unit that need to be given all of the respect. And if they are fit and firing, and they have this core of midfield that they can utilize, I don't think anyone's getting through them. Like, I think that this side under Bielsa is about as perfect a match as you could possibly ask for. And in a time where Brazil don't have that direction in charge of their team, right now I would trust Uruguay to win these games more than I would trust Brazil to do them.
Yeah, I mean, I've been impressed by, you know, just watching their last game and seeing how they took to the Bielsa philosophy and how someone like Darwin is going to benefit from that in his club football, probably, as much as his international football. And I think that the team, because of their age and the stage that they're at, this is perfect for Bielsa to get hold of them. Like, in terms of what is demanded of you in a Bielsa team, as we've seen time and time again, and the relentless running and work rate that is involved, but also the technical preciseness of what's needed in order to score a goal in this way of playing football. Uruguay have got it all. They can actually pull off this style of football. It looks like this could be a masterstroke appointment. And if they don't win the tournament, then they surely will come close, because anything else, and you'll just be wondering what it will take, because this feels like a golden moment for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And right at number one, current world champions, Argentina. It's very difficult to look past them. Yes, they lost to Uruguay. There were question marks about how that team and how that game played out. But, you know, up to that point, they hadn't lost since Saudi Arabia beat them in the opener at the World Cup. They hadn't conceded since the World Cup final. And taking aside the kind of, that game's a weird one in that Bielsa is obviously coming up against his homeland, a team that he used to manage. There's a lot of emotion. It's at a different stadium. It's at the Bombonera. The ground is smaller. Everything fell in Uruguay's favour. And whilst Uruguay are an excellent team, as well, I've got them at two, I think that generally, if you play that game across, you know, a period of time, and you play that game in what is going to be the Copa, I think Argentina come out on top. So that's the only the trigger I'm looking at here, in that it might be, as we talked about, the fact that this might be Lionel Messi's last tournament with Argentina. He said at the end of the World Cup that he was not going to make another World Cup. So I can imagine there being that added to the narrative. Like, oh, go and win another one. Let's just make sure that this legacy is secure. We talked about the fact that they'll have one eye on the European Championships, and that's going to be something else, and whether Portugal can dominate over there, and that might add a third layer to this. But just Argentina as a unit under Scaloni, there's been so little to dislike. The way that they play football is glorious. The depth that they have, the ability to change things up in-game, it's all just working at the moment. And Argentina are far more than the sum of their parts, and the sum of their parts is pretty good right now. Ooh. I think it's very difficult to look past them. Now, look, we could get to March and there might be key injuries to someone like Enzo, to Alexis, to Rodrigo de Paul, to Messi, to Julian Alvarez. But you look at the players stepping up into those spots. Lautaro Martinez, Paulo Dybala's back in the squad. That's nice. Angel Di Maria still here and flying at Benfica, been a very, very impressive signing for them, despite them having a bad season. You look at the players stepping up into these spots. Okay, there's a little bit of a question mark at the base of midfield. If you lose someone like Alexis, can Ezequiel Palacios step up? It's been good when he's played for Leverkusen this season. Is Paredes finished? I think so, but you know, there's plenty of people might disagree with me. Just generally, though, there's just a feeling about Argentina at the moment. They're riding the crest of a wave, and I think it's very difficult to look past that.
Mate, so what we've just predicted is that there's a very good chance that on July the 14th, 2024... Messi and Ronaldo could be holding aloft trophies, because both the finals are on the same day. The Euros final and the Copa America tournaments come to an end on the same date on other sides of the world, albeit. Vibes. But can you imagine, this rivalry has that twist in it too, that they both can go on and do that. Like, this was genuinely is not supposed to be a Messi-Ronaldo show at all, and this is completely not where you're heading. And I know that Portugal aren't our favourites, France are, but the fact that Portugal are there at two with Ronaldo, Argentina are there at top, and Messi's going to be playing, that's a narrative that even I'm here for, mate.
Hashtag narrative FC. We're having a time. Yeah. We're having a time. Right, with that, I think we'll come to an end on the Copa America rankings. We've got a last little bit for you after the break. We're going to be talking a couple of hot takes, so stick with us. Welcome back to Ranks FC. It's time for a little bit of fun in part three. Dean, you've got some scorching hot takes for us. Let's hear them.
I have, yeah. If you're not on Patreon, then now is definitely the time, because I'm going digging around Patreon at the moment. And I thought, right, if they're not bringing the hot takes to me, I'm going to go there and get the hot takes from them. Go and join our Patreon now. It's a free trial available. There's a link in the description for you to go and do that. Honestly, it's great fun. And I went in there and I said, right, give me your hot takes on the Euros or Copa America. And I've got a load of responses. I'm going to read out a few of them that I liked, and maybe a few will catch you by surprise even, Jack. The first one I'm going to go with is from Bolivar Vargas, who says, Ecuador will make it to at least the semi-finals of the Copa. There are a lot of very talented young players coming through for Ecuador, including Moise Caicedo, Piero Hinsapi, William Pacho, Kendry Páez. This is one of the best South American academies we've seen so far in Independiente del Valle, and the national team is starting to reflect that. Ecuador had one of the youngest teams at the 2022 World Cup, and I think this Copa could be a breakout tournament for a lot of their young players. He says, cheers and love the pod. Well, I love the hot take, even though it was very hard for me to read half of that stuff out. Probably should have practiced that before reading it just live on the pod. But Ecuador, they didn't get a mention in your top five, mate, but there's some good reason in there.
Yeah, no, they're a really talented young side. I wonder if that maybe counts against them in terms of just still being a little bit young, but generally, actually, if you look at their qualification record so far, it's been pretty impressive. They've only lost to Argentina. They beat this Uruguay side. They were deducted 3 points for something quite random. They falsified documents or something, which is a bit weird. But they've drawn with Colombia and Venezuela, who are both in pretty good form as well. They're definitely in the mix. And they won in La Paz as well, which is obviously the hardest place to go in international football and get a result. So lots to like about this Ecuador side. I think that they're lots of fun. And we've seen in the youngsters that they have the ability to make things happen. And look, if they click and these youngsters get going, then there's absolutely no way, no reason that they can't shock a few people in this tournament, I don't think.
Lovely stuff. Right, we've got a take on the USMNT now from TJ Fogarty, who is one of our real ultras of this podcast. He says, if the USMNT don't get past the quarterfinals of the Copa America, they need to fire Greg Berhalter. The coach's numbers are heavily buoyed by winning games at home, but if he can't do it against CONMEBOL's best, I don't expect the US to do much better when UEFA teams get added to the mix in 2026 for the World Cup. Hosting the World Cup is a massive opportunity, and unless Berhalter can do something this tournament, they're going to waste another cycle with this stagnation. Annoying that the USSF have already said his performance in Copa America won't affect his job, because it very much should.
Yeah,
that is right.
You've got to be judged on your performances at tournaments.
Surely,
right? Like if this doesn't affect his job, then that's wild. Like if the US were to go out and crash and burn, then surely they'd have to have a look at this. I struggle with putting an absolute time on it, because what if they come up in the quarterfinals against Argentina? Like,
yeah, sure. Yeah.
But when you do look at it in that kind of sense, that would probably have involved them coming second in the group. So, you know, when you're looking at it that kind of way, it does reflect, and you should be able to qualify, and you should be able to get at least to the quarters. If the US don't get out of the group, they have to have a real look at this. So I think that the idea that performances won't be judged at the Copa is wild. And why the US decided to say that, I have absolutely no idea. But yeah, I mean, I think that you have to contextualize in terms of who they come up against. But his performances should definitely be under scrutiny, yes.
Okay, this is the last one I'm going to do from today. And it's from Michael Lewis, who is one of my favorite Rank Squad listeners, because he took me to a football match in San Diego once. Michael says, I'm predicting super sexy Szoboszlai to lead Hungary through the group stage and into the knockout rounds at the Euros. I don't think Hungary as a whole is talented enough to win a knockout game. However, they will carry some momentum from their qualifying campaign and pull some upsets in the groups. And another one of our patrons, Valentin, jumped on the back of this. Valentin's usually our Bundesliga expert, but he jumps in and he says, Hungary have really taken football to another level in this decade. Their impressive showing in the group of death last Euros in 2021 and their incredible showing in the Nation Leagues have shown a real domination. There are a few other UEFA countries who have been this consistently great over the last three competitive duties that they've carried out. But he says, yeah, the tournament track record is not there, but the confidence and the team spirit is. And if they get lucky with opponents, Hungary could massively exceed expectations.
Yeah, 100%. I think this is a really good shout. And actually, the way that they're bouncing through at the moment is really interesting. They've got some really intriguing players. Obviously, Szoboszlai is the one that tends to grab the headlines. But Milos Kerkez, who came in to Bournemouth this summer from the Eredivisie, is a really, really good left back. And he plays left wing back for Hungary and is allowed to just maraud forward more than he is for his club side. And I really, really like it. I think that this side maybe lacks the kind of star power you'd expect in the forward line. But the way that they're working with Szoboszlai on that kind of left-hand side, drifting in and making things happen. We saw Roland Saloy score one of the best goals of the tournament so far. He's been brilliant for Freiburg for a couple of years now. And he's, you know, just one of those players that you really enjoy watching, has the ability to make things happen out of nowhere. They're a really well-balanced side under Rossi. And I think that what we've seen from them, the way that they dispatched Serbia in that group, it wasn't an easy qualifying group, I don't think, by any stretch of the imagination. And they were able to fight their way through it and make things happen. I really like this Hungary side. Obviously, it all depends on who they get drawn against, etc. And the fact that they're probably going to be pot C doesn't help them in that regard. But they're going to be a nightmare to play against for a lot of teams. And we saw that. We've seen that in the last couple of tournaments. I really like them and I'm really enjoying watching this kind of restoration of Magyar pride in this Hungary side.
Amazing, amazing. So thanks for people for getting in touch with those. There's loads more on there. So if you do want to have a dig through some more hot takes from the Rank Squad, then they're all in the thread on there. On the Patreon
feed. Maybe
we'll
discuss a few more on Thursday's Patreon episodes.
We should do, actually, mate. We easily could do that.
There you go. There you go. There's something to join the Patreon for. We'll look through the rest of those hot takes on Thursday. But for now, all that's left for me to do is to say thank you very much to Mr. Dean Jones.
Cheers, mate.
I've been Jack Collins. This has been Ranks FC, looking at the favourites, the early favourites for the Copa America and European Championships next summer. We hope you've enjoyed this episode and we'll see you very shortly, gang. Take it easy. Peace.